Thanks for spending some of your day with us on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along, and great to have back Madison attorney Michael Riley. His practice is focused on obtaining fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence. And he also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, in mediation, and in arbitration. So lots we can talk about with him today. Maybe we'll start with class action cases, though. Do you have questions relating to that area, or are you concerned about your insurance coverage? Join the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Michael Riley, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Larry, it's great to be back.
I tell you what, let's start with class actions. And, you know, I think most of us have a general idea of what's involved, but maybe I think it's worth it to really explain what a class action case is.
Sure, and, you know, I'll try not to be too lawyerish about it. You know, class actions are really situations where a number of people may have been injured by a product, a device, but, you know, it's the kind of thing, it's obviously very different than a car accident because generally there's one or two or very few people injured. These are things where something has caused injury to a great number of people. You can go back to the tobacco litigation. You know, right now you're seeing litigation involving Roundup and a bunch of different products. And I don't think anybody can watch TV without seeing any number of ads about different products, different devices. And I think the thing that people need to know is that class action itself is a good thing, because what it does is if you were going to sue Philip Morris back in the day, or you wanted to sue the makers of Roundup right now as an individual, it just, the amount of money it would take to do that for one person would make it almost completely impossible. So a class action bands together a large number of people who may have been injured by the same product, and there you can pool all the resources. You get lawyers, a bunch of different lawyers involved, and they pool resources, and all the testing and, you know, investigation and everything that needs to be done in order to maintain a lawsuit gets shared by a bunch of people. So it makes perfect sense to do that. The question, then there's also sort of another form of that. It's a little different thing, but they call it multi-district litigation. It's similar in the sense that you take a bunch of cases there that have been brought by individuals and you combine them all in front of one court to try to get them all resolved. So it's a little different, but kind of the same idea. The reason that I raised it, go ahead, Larry.
No, I was just, go ahead and talk about the reason you raise it.
Okay, well, the reason I raised it is because, again, we're seeing an awful lot of commercials. And if you read the fine print under the commercial, what you see is the person who's on TV and spending money on the ads is usually not the person that's going to end up representing you. It may be in some cases, but in many, if not most, it's not. It's somebody who is advertising. They're basically trolling for clients. They're going to get those clients, and then they're going to send them off to a different lawyer because they're not licensed to practice in a lot of the areas that where people live. And, you know, my concern with that is just that you're not really having much input into who represents you. The individual, the lawyers in that case who, you know, are handling, taking all these cases in, aren't really involved in a personal relationship with you. It's a monetary relationship because they're ultimately going to make, they hope, a great deal of money when these cases settle, and many of them do. And some of the ads talk about, you know, so much money has been set aside to settle these cases. You know, and it's certainly worth exploring. I wouldn't want to discourage anyone who felt they had a legitimate claim from exploring it. But the one thing I would strongly suggest is talk to a local personal injury lawyer, somebody who does the kind of work I do. There are a number of excellent lawyers in our area who do that work. And, you know, talk to them, because they can often, some of them are handling these cases already, are involved in these cases. But at the very least, they can give you a recommendation about what to do. They're not, shouldn't charge you for that. You can ask about that, but virtually all personal injury lawyers will do consultations with no charge up front. And, you know, before you sign on to one of these national outfits that are spending a lot of money advertising to try to sign folks up, it's worthwhile talking to somebody local so that you have a personal connection with the lawyer that's involved.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense to me, for sure. And then what happens? You know, let's say you sign on, and I guess you basically contact that attorney or the appropriate attorney. What happens if the case is won, or what happens when the case is won, let's say?
Well, first of all, the vast majority of cases of all kinds settle. You know, the chances that it will go to trial are very small. It could happen. Usually what happens, whether it's in a class action or in multi-district litigation, there are a handful of cases are tried, you know, very small. Usually the plaintiffs kind of try to pick their strongest cases. The defense may try to pick one or two to try where they think they've got the best arguments. And at the end of the day, those results kind of dictate what happens to the rest of the cases. Because obviously if, you know, the cases are tried and the company who manufactures the product loses, well, at that point, they don't want to try, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 of these and get big, big verdicts. So they're going to try to settle and settle all the cases at once. And whether it's, you know, a class action or multi-district litigation, that's normally what's going to happen. There's going to be some pattern cases, and then likely a settlement will be reached. Now, you know, if the cases are tried and the company prevails, well, then they may say, hey, we're going to stand and fight. But much more often than not, that's not what happens. The cases do settle. And then what happens is there's a proposed distribution. There are going to be fees are going to come out of it, costs. There are going to be a bunch of things. And at some point, you're going to get letters saying, look, you know, here's the proposed settlement. Here's what you're going to realize from that. And usually you have the opportunity to opt out. So you may be able to say at that point, and again, I should say to begin with, class actions are not my specialty, so I'm not here trolling for business, believe me. But they are usually what happens is then you have an opportunity to opt out. Most people aren't going to. Most people are going to say, okay, that makes sense to me. The one kind of class action that I don't like, Larry, and I see a lot of, and you may have gotten the same thing, I get these letters in the mail announcing that, you know, because of some vehicle I bought 20 years ago or a stock I bought 20 years ago or 5 years ago or whatever, there's been a settlement and, you know, I'm going to get $43.21 and the attorneys are getting, you know, $23 million in fees. And those bother me where you've got really a small payout to each of the members of the class of people who've suffered an injury, suffered a wrong. And the lawyers are making quite a lot of money. I often just don't bother to respond to those. You know, often they want information that I can't give them. That's not usually a problem with a class action. If you've been physically injured by a product, those tend to be more straightforward. But that's generally the process. At some point, it's likely they will settle. You'll get contacted and asked to, you know, if you're willing to accept the settlement. I think the vast majority of people do. The vast majority of people obviously weren't probably going to pursue this at all had they not seen the ad or been contacted and, you know, in some fashion and told that there's this, you know, possibility of bringing the claim. So, again, it's not that these are bad things or that people shouldn't do it. That's not the point. I think it is worthwhile talking to somebody local so that you feel like you've got a little more control, because otherwise, honestly, it's, you know, boy, you're just, you know, you have almost no control at all. You're a very small fish in a very big pond. And, you know, that's not always a great feeling.
Pat just emailed that his wife just learned she's getting $50,000 gross in a class action suit. And he's wondering, what are the typical lawyer fees and taxes that would come out of it?
Well, if she's getting $50,000 gross, they should, when they notify you, it should tell you specifically how much is coming out of that. So is he sure it's gross and not net? Because normally, he says gross. That's what it is. That's before. Well, there's usually the attorney's fees can range anywhere. There's usually in the neighborhood of a third. That's fairly standard. I frankly am troubled by that. Courts can control that. A court has to approve it. And a court always has to approve fees. They're always subject to court approval, even though they're not often disputed. But they're subject to the court's approval. What I find troubling in some of these cases, in fact, many of them, is that, look, a lawyer, somebody out there spent time and energy and effort to try to round people up and, you know, then to research this, to prepare it, to do what they have to do. And I have no problem where somebody really is lead counsel, where they're the first people that did this and put a lot of energy and a lot of money into it. You know, a third fee doesn't seem at all unfair. The costs can be fairly substantial, although, again, in a class action, they're spread across so many people that the cost should not be all that substantial. But the big thing would likely be the fee, but they have to tell you what that is because they have to submit it for court approval, and you can have input into that. Now, again, any one individual is not likely going to sway the court a great deal, but if something seems unfair, certainly, you know, you can have input. Again, that's where having local counsel helps, I think, because they obviously are probably better placed to know exactly how to deal with that or if it seems appropriate to contact the court, how to go about doing that. I think it's a lot harder for an individual. But that it should be, when you're notified, you should get a document that tells you exactly what the fees are going to be and the costs.
Mike Riley, our guest today, we started by talking about class action suits. The other side of it is personal injury. Is a person getting sued? And maybe insurance coverage and what kinds of insurance companies people should have. And we'll be taking that up as well as we visit with Mike. And, of course, taking your questions, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about legal matters today. We've zeroed in a bit on class action lawsuits. We can talk personal injury. And, of course, the other side of the coin, which is getting sued, our guest, Mike Riley, again, Mike, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Bill in Lancaster, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I was wondering about if you knew anything about the 3M lawsuit for the hearing earplugs and whatnot.
Yeah, I know, you know, and I don't, again, I'm certainly no expert on that one, but as I recall, it had to do with the earplugs they made for the military, and the allegation was that the plugs were inadequate, which led to hearing loss. I don't know if they may have been used for civilian uses, too. I believe the stories I saw had to do with the use in the military. And I don't have specific information about that. That's one that's widespread enough so that, again, I did see that advertised a while back. I have not seen it in a while. I think it would certainly be worth talking to, a local law firm, if talk to a lawyer who does that work, and just see if they're involved in those or if they're willing to take those cases. And if not, you know, maybe they can give you some advice on who to contact. The one other thing I should have said, and I want to say right now, is that one of the real positives of a class action is, again, these are contingency fee cases, which most personal injury cases are. That just means the lawyer gets a percentage of what he collects for you. There are no hourly fees. There's no charges. You're not going to owe a bill. There are generally, certainly in a class action, you don't have any obligation for costs out of your pocket. You're going to pay costs, a portion of the costs, when the case settles or is resolved, assuming there's a recovery. But you aren't going to get a bill from anybody. You're not going to be out of pocket, and that obviously is a positive. But on the 3M thing, one, I'm sure you can go online and find things on it, which is certainly worth doing, too. But I talked to, you know, a local law firm that focuses on personal injury. we're going to talk a little bit about that later, but Madison Magazine, Milwaukee Magazine, both do best lawyer things every year. Those are generally very good people that get listed in those publications. And there's obviously other ways to find lawyers. I'm not fond of TV advertising as a way to do that, but, you know, there are a lot of other sources out there.
Good enough. Bill, thank you. Mark in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, thanks for the opportunity. Several years ago, I filed suit with the state to try to get an EIS, environmental impact statement, filed for a spraying program that they had going along the West Shore. Council reviewed it. I was just a private individual. This wasn't class or anything like that. And I was advised that if I were to lose the suit, I could be on the hook for the opposing lawyer fees, and that was the Department of Justice through the DNR. Is that true? Is that true?
When do you have to pay
Yeah, that's called loser pays. It's rare, Bill. I can't tell you specifically about that because that's not my bailiwick, really, is environmental stuff. For the most part, it's not true. Generally speaking, you know, in this state, everybody in our country and in our state bears responsibility for their own attorney's fees. The exception, there are exceptions. They're generally statutory exceptions. There are exceptions under some federal laws. There are exceptions under some state laws where specifically it provides that if you bring an action and you lose, you have to pay for the other side's fees. But it is very unusual, and if you're being told that, I'd ask them to cite the statute or cite the authority for that. And I'm not saying that your lawyer's wrong. They may well be correct in that particular case, but that is highly unusual. In a normal personal injury action, that's not the case at all. It certainly is not the case in class actions that, you know, somehow you could be on, you know, on the hook for a portion of the defense legal fees if the case isn't resolved favorably.
Mark, thank you again. Appreciate it. Well, let's take another call. Pat in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good morning. Say, I was just wondering with the Purdue Pharma case, the Sackler family, can the individuals or families that filed a claim, can they expect anything with the way the settlement was brokered and done?
I would certainly think so. I mean, that's a very substantial settlement. As I recall, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. So I would expect, and again, I know there are thousands and thousands of claimants, but I would still expect that in that case there'd be some real money, and it wouldn't, you know, it would not expect that to be a nominal settlement. I would expect that to be fairly substantial. Again, I don't know enough about the details, how many claimants there are, but just looking at the scope of the settlement, I would think individuals would get some. You know, I know some of this is, you know, you've got states involved and all sorts of other things, which obviously complicates it. But again, I would certainly expect that individuals would receive something that would be more than just a nominal amount of money.
Thank you, Pat. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. How do you, you know, we're talking about lawyers and picking a lawyer, and you've made some comments relating to it today, Mike, and how do you suggest people find a good lawyer?
Well, it's not easy, and I don't know, shouldn't say that's not easy. I mean, it's a challenge because, you know, it's much like when I go to a doctor. I actually work with a lot of doctors, you know, professionally just because of what I do in dealing with injuries. But the fact is, you know, I go to a doctor, I don't know, and a lot of them, you know, most lawyers are, you know, if you're doing what I do, you better be friendly and have some people skills or you're not going to last long. But, you know, I always laugh. We have a place in Montana, and we've had to do some things to our place over time, and we learned pretty early on that everybody's got a great smile and a firm handshake, but, you know, that's no guarantee that you're getting what you need in terms of ability or, you know, willingness to actually do the work and charge you fairly. So what the point I think that's most important as far as I'm concerned, Larry, is one, go out and talk to one or two lawyers. Go interview the lawyer before you make a final decision. Your cases, especially cases involving a significant injury, are going to take, you know, more than a year to resolve, usually 2 years, up to three. you are highly unlikely to end up in a courtroom anymore. So few cases go to trial. Almost everything settles. But that doesn't mean that the lawyer's skills and abilities aren't important. Good lawyers get better settlements for a lot of reasons. One, they know how to put a case together. They know how to sell that case to the other side. They prepare their client if the case goes into suit, which a lot of cases do now, even though they don't go to trial. They prepare their people properly for depositions. They, you know, submit demands that are meaningful. And ultimately, they go to a mediation. They pick a good mediator, and they do a good job in the mediation. And all of that makes a real difference in how much you get compensated. There are firms out there who do a lot of advertising on TV, and some of them are very good firms, and some, frankly, are not the best, in my view at least, and I think in most people's, most other lawyers' view. And the question is, you know, you want somebody, a lawyer, a law firm, it can be, could be a big firm, but you want somebody that's going to treat your case as something that is unique, is important, is critical to you. Lawyers have a lot of cases. Clients have one, and you've got to have a lawyer who recognizes that and is going to give your case the attention it deserves. I mentioned, you know, Madison Magazine does a Best Lawyers edition every year. Milwaukee Magazine does something they call Super Lawyers. When they first brought it out, there were a few of us in our firm that got named, and so we put on, we had a little ad with superhero costumes, which I thought was kind of cute. Our business clients didn't think it was so funny, but I did. But anyway, I mean, those are good sources. Martindale Hubbell, I think it was used to be one of the better sources. I don't know how accessible it is anymore. I think you can go online. It's Martindale Hubbell, H-U-B-B-E-L-L. And they do ratings of lawyers. Should have a lawyer who's an AV lawyer, honestly. That's the top rating. There are a fair number of lawyers. The Milwaukee Magazine and Madison Magazine are more selective. If you know people who have, if you know a lawyer who does something other than personal injury work, you can talk to them, see if they can give you a referral. But again, ultimately, go and meet with the lawyer and talk to him. You're going to ultimately have to rely heavily on that lawyer's advice in terms of settlement, because that's what's going to happen to your case. And you have to have somebody that you trust, that you feel has your best interests at heart, and that you feel. The other thing, we are really strong on communicating with clients. I tell every client, they have my cell number, they have my, you know, they have my office number. They make it clear from the beginning that they can call me anytime they need to, and I think that's critical. You want a lawyer who's going to communicate with you, keep you in the loop, is going to be willing to talk to you. It's very frustrating when you're injured and you're just waiting for things to happen. And there are a lot of dead times when you're waiting for people to recover. Even once you file the lawsuit, there are periods of time when not a lot is happening. And, you know, clients are anxious, they're frustrated, which is completely understandable. But you want a lawyer you can talk to and who you can trust. And I think the best way to do that is to look first and try to find somebody that's got, you know, good peer ratings. And that's where how those ratings come in the magazines. They come from other lawyers doing that kind of work. And ultimately, you want somebody who you've talked to and say, you know what, I'm comfortable with this person.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Don in Sheboygan, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
I wanted to find out about homeowners associations and liability. I looked at a lot and it had a homeowners association, and there was some clause in their association bylaws that said the directors or whatever can be held not liable for any decisions they make. And I was wondering if they get sued, is that spread over the cost, spread over all the lot owners and that type of thing?
It shouldn't be done. Again, you know, I obviously don't know about the document, and saying that in the homeowners association probably doesn't mean much if a third party sues you. You know, we've all seen this debacle in Florida with the condo collapse, and, you know, because all the people who built it and designed it and everything are long gone or out of business or dead or whatever. There's a real risk there that certainly the directors at least are going to get sued. Now, whether it'll be successful is another issue. For the most part, what happens is homeowners associations should have insurance. So if anyone is injured in a common area or there's a lawsuit, you know, of any kind, that deals with the association as a whole, there should be insurance that would cover that. And one of the things you do want to do is make sure you know what, how much insurance do they have. You know, is it an adequate amount of insurance? Because you don't want to be in a position where you, as a member of the Homeowners Association, might have personal exposure. I think it would be highly unusual for that to happen. But, again, I think it's very certainly prudent to know what insurance coverage they have so that you're not in that position. That sounds like a different situation than a condo thing where, like this condo, one of the problems there is if you have problems with the condo itself where it needs to be rebuilt or, you know, repaired, then you do have the potential to have to contribute to that, and that can be a real concern too. So whenever you go into something like that, that's a sort of joint venture, if you will, where you have a number of people banded together, it really is important to look at the documents, see what you're signing on for, see what your potential exposure is, and then make sure that you know what insurance coverage is available to take care of any potential liability you might have.
Yeah. Don, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. That's got to be a real mess on that Florida. Oh, boy.
It's a disaster. I mean, the loss of life is obviously the real disaster and tragedy. That's horrible. But it's going to, the litigation thing's going to be a mess. I mean, there's all sorts of lawsuits already, and now it's difficult. And there's the insurance is going to be grossly inadequate to begin to cover that.
James in Reedsburg will give you a chance. Hi, James.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had hernia meshes installed over 9 years ago, and they all failed, which required my abdomen to be reconstructed. And I filed a lawsuit that went through two lawyer firms, and I understand they're going to get 40%, but my God, it's been almost 9 years, and it's just getting to the courts now. The last time I talked to my lawyers, I found out there was 14,000 cases, and it goes through a medical team of the lawyer firm to see which cases qualify, and mine has, because of the fact that they failed and the surgeon removed pieces of the three meshes. We couldn't locate all of them.
Hmm. Well, what in that kind of situation, Mike, here's 9 years. That seems like a long time to me.
It's bizarre. I don't, you know, again, you know, my cases, personal injury cases, a couple of years is not at all unusual. Three is pushing it. And I'm not suggesting they can't go beyond that. They can for a lot of reasons. Often people are still treating. This is just different. And some of that is discovery and putting everything together. But, frankly, 9 years. Is it 9 years since you hired the lawyers?
Yeah, at least 8 or 9 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I mean, that strikes me as highly unusual, to be perfectly honest. Are the lawyers local, or are they, did you sign on with somebody who, you know, is advertising or whatever, but like a national firm or a firm that is handling a bunch of cases for all sorts of people?
Yeah, they're out of Texas.
Yeah. It's just, and again, look, I don't know all the facts of this. It may be that that's just how long it's taken. Some states are obviously bogged down a lot more than others. 9 years really strikes me as extraordinary, to be honest. But it's just another example of why I think if you can, and I'm not being critical of you in any way, you know, I'm sure you saw this and you said, gee, I want to explore it, excuse me, and that, you know, that was the right thing to do. I still think that's why I prefer at least having a local contact lawyer who can, you know, isn't representing 14,000 people or 4,000 and is more likely to be able to kind of keep me in the loop on what's going on. Have they told, and it, there's no settlement at this point? Is it actually going to trial, or where are they, Don, on this?
They're actually bringing some of the cases to trial. Finally.
Yeah, well, and that's what, as I said earlier, that tends to be what happens. They'll do these pattern cases where they'll try a series of the cases, and then once they have those results, those will usually set the parameters for the settlements. So you know, they'll say, okay, the good ones went here, the bad ones went here. Let's find a number somewhere in between that kind of balances the risk. And then some of it's always a question of, you know, who is, oh, this is, you know, depends on how big the outfit is that did the mesh. You know, are they big enough so that, you know, they're going to be able to pay any judgment that's out there? And with, you know, something like Purdue Pharma, you can see, I mean, you can be talking hundreds of millions of dollars. So companies don't begin to have that kind of insurance. It's usually a matter of, you know, get the company's assets too. So there is a lot involved. Once you see one or two of these cases tried, or three, however many they decide, then it should move fairly quickly. I will say, and I've seen, it's not that I don't see it, 40% to me is an extraordinarily high fee. I know they do it in Chicago. They do it other places. I'm disappointed that a court would approve that. I don't think it's fair. But, yeah, you know, that's, everybody does what they do, and I guess they, maybe that's what they do in Texas.
James, thank you again for calling. Another James, this one in Kenosha. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about a waiver that I signed recently. We went zip lining, and this waiver must have been 15 pages long. There's no way I could have reasonably read and understood what I was signing. Am I putting myself at risk in situations like this?
No. You've come to the right place for this one. I actually litigated this and established the law in the state that the waivers aren't effective. Generally speaking, first of all, people are asked to sign waivers for their children. Those don't work at all, okay? Generally speaking, even a waiver you sign for yourself is not something that's going to be effective. And the reason it's not effective is the courts have said that in order to be effective, they have to pass a number of tests. And the tests basically say you have to have an opportunity to negotiate. Nobody has an opportunity to negotiate. Nobody says, you know, look, why don't we, is there anything here you don't like, and we'll change it for you, you know. Or if you, I've always told people, ask me sometimes, well, is there some way to get around that? Well, if I were running a business and I want to try to make it work, I'd say, look, if you sign the waiver, you get to go for $5, but if you don't, it's going to cost you $10. I don't know that even, I don't think that would work either. The other thing the courts have said is they can't be unduly broad. Well, you just told me it was 15 pages. And I don't know what kind of stupid lawyer drafted it for him, because, frankly, nothing is dumber than, if you really wanted to have some chance of having it work, you'd draft a one-page waiver, not a 15-page waiver. Because a 15-page waiver is, you know, based on everything the court has said, is just by virtue of the fact that it's 15 pages, is not going to be enforceable. So these are, our courts have looked at this in a lot of different contexts. There was a swimming pool case I had originally, but I've handled them in ski area cases and other things. And generally speaking, they don't work. We do have a bunch of laws that you know, can provide some immunities, but I don't think any of them would apply there. There's a very broad recreational immunity law, but it doesn't apply if you make your land available for recreational purposes. There's very broad immunity, but that doesn't apply when you're paying money for something like that. So that wouldn't bar it either.
There you go, James. Thank you so much for calling. John in Appleton called to ask if you could explain Wisconsin's castle law.
Well, you know what? I'm trying to remember. I don't think Wisconsin has a castle law, although they've talked about it. And I may be wrong. Again, not my field particularly. The castle law is basically, one, it's ridiculous. It's just, what it does is it says, I mean, it's a little like the stand your ground laws. And I guess maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we do have a castle law, but not a stand your ground law. The bottom line is what the castle law says: man's home is his castle. If somebody comes into your castle, you get to defend it. And so pretty much you have carte blanche to do what you want to do to defend yourself and your family. You know, these things got popular because there was a case somewhere, you know, years ago, where somebody shot an intruder, and then the intruder sued because, you know, he's badly injured and said it wasn't necessary to shoot him. And so then legislatures everywhere rushed to pass laws. No, no, it's fine. If somebody intrudes, go ahead and shoot him. And, you know, that's really what it is. It's man's home is his castle. You can do whatever you need to do to defend your castle. As a practical matter, are the laws, am I I am offended by the stand your ground law. That's a dangerous and unnecessary thing. Castle laws, I'm not nearly as offended by. Do I think they're really necessary? No. The chances that somebody's going to come into your house to try to rob you or do whatever they're trying to harm you, and that you do, you know, you do what you need to do to defend yourself, and I'm just saying what you need to do, interpreted extremely broadly, really believe that a lawyer is going to take that lawsuit? I wouldn't, and I don't think any other lawyer would either. So, you know, I think it was one of those solutions in search of a problem, but that's essentially what it is. It gives you very broad rights to defend your home.
Michael Riley, our guest, a Madison attorney with the Axley Law Firm. We've talked about class action lawsuits and some other legal matters with him, and you can join in as well. Works a lot in personal injury and insurance coverages. I want to talk with him about the kinds of insurance coverages we ought to have for situations, and we'll get to that in just a second or two. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at legal issues on the program today, zeroed in a bit on class action, talking personal injury, insurance and insurance coverage, insurance mediation with our guest Mike Riley. Michael Riley, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm located in Madison. Great to have him with us. Questions for Mike? I hope you'll give a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So the other side of the personal injury is the person getting sued. What kind of insurance coverage should the average person have, Mike?
That's a great topic, Larry. And the first thing, if I can just briefly, I know I mentioned the dog situation, and it's because I'm representing a couple whose dog ended up biting a neighbor kid, and it's a real issue in this case, the amount of coverage. I thought it might be worthwhile just talking about that briefly. And I'm a former dog owner, dog lover, love to pet dogs. Dogs are wonderful. I don't want anybody to get the impression that I am anti-dog, but it is important that you know what your insurance policy says about coverage for dog bites. And under Wisconsin law, if your dog bites somebody, you're responsible, almost period. There's some leeway if the other person, you know, attacks your dog and it bites, that might be. But the vast majority of situations, the law makes you responsible, whether you did anything negligent or not. I mean, you might be doing everything right, but if somebody gets bitten by your dog, you're generally going to be held legally responsible for that. What's happened more recently is those injuries would normally be covered under your homeowner's policy. It's interesting. If a dog's riding in your car and it bites somebody, your car policy might cover it because the question is whether it arises out of the use of the vehicle. And there's a case where a guy had left his dog in the back of the pickup and it bit somebody. And the court said, well, you know, that arose out of the use of the pickup. So your auto policy covers, but obviously most bites occur in your yard, in your home, or even if you're out walking your dog somewhere. And those are covered by your homeowner's policy. Companies now are often restricting that coverage, and particularly if your dog has bitten previously. And so it's really important you check with your agent or look at your policy and make sure you know how much coverage you have, because in one case, the case I'm dealing with, the policy provision limits coverage to $25,000. Well, boy, in an age where, you know, an emergency room bill can get close to that pretty quickly, that just doesn't begin to be enough coverage. And so, you know, it is really important to check with your agent, check your policy, and make sure you've got enough coverage if that happens. There are a lot of other provisions, too, in policies that may limit coverage under certain circumstances. Sometimes they'll define what is a dangerous dog, and sometimes it really isn't at all what you or I would think of as a dangerous dog. But, you know, there, if the policy says it's a dangerous dog, that may limit your coverage or bar coverage completely. Two other things real quickly on that. One, I do a fair number of dog bite cases. A lot of the bites I see are rescue dogs. And again, I'm not for a moment suggesting people not adopt rescue dogs.
I am saying that you need to be careful.
Oh, I think
you
we're
got me.
Oh, we got you. Hold now, on. Mike. You're back.
Okay, I don't know. I'm sorry. My car switched it off for a second. All right, great. So anyway, so just talking about rescue dogs. What happens is people often don't have any history on the dog, and frankly, some of the outfits that do rescue dogs aren't very good about that, and they may have been not told either. Somebody, you know, gives the dog up. It may be, not necessarily at all, but it could be because they'd had a problem with the dog. At the end of the day, if you're going to do a rescue dog, be careful to be sure you take some time, be sure the dog's socialized, be sure, you know, how it's going to react. I have a case right now where a guy who had just adopted this dog, took it to a dog park, and it immediately attacked another dog, attacked the owner, and now it's a mess. So, you know, I think that's an important consideration. Finally, kids are the ones who get bit and get bit most severely because they're right down there face-to-face with dogs. Many dogs, even very nice dogs, don't react well to kids in their face. And, of course, when they bite the kid in the face, and that can be a really, really bad thing. So those are just things to think about and to be careful about with dogs. Let me talk a little bit about insurance coverage generally. You know, everybody has homeowners. If you have a home and you have a mortgage, you have homeowners. If your kid's going off to college or, you know, if you're a renter, get renter's insurance. Renter's insurance provides not only coverage for, you know, your property, but it gives you liability coverage, and that can be very important. Obviously, one, if somebody's injured, you know, in your apartment and it's your fault, not just because somebody's injured doesn't make you responsible, but if something's wrong and somebody's injured and you are negligent in some way, then, you know, you could have an exposure. The other thing that happens is if you have, you know, you have a fire in your kitchen. I see those cases all the time. I just dealt with one where somebody's moving in and they left a box on a cooktop, you know, one of these ceramic cooktops, not realizing it was on. And, of course, then they go back out, the box catches fire, and there's a bunch of damage to the place. And now the owners are suing them for the damage. Well, if you have renter's insurance, that would likely cover that. So it's really, it's an important thing, not just for the kids, but for the parents,
yeah.
Because parents often sign as guarantors on the leases. So, you know, it's a good idea to make sure that there is renter's insurance. It's not very expensive, and it's certainly worth having just for the peace of mind. Homeowners insurance, again, you know, that tends to have fairly standard rates. Most often your liability coverage is somewhere between $100 and $300. That may be enough. It may not. If you've got significant assets, and boy, a home has become a very, you know, more significant asset every year, you know, as prices go up and up and up, you know, if you don't really have anything that anyone can get, then insurance isn't quite so important. If you do, including equity in your home, you get to shield a little bit of that, but not a whole lot. And if you've got significant equity in your home or other property, You really should have an umbrella policy beyond $100,000. $100,000 is just not enough. Medical bills just mount up so quickly now. It's not at all unusual to see claims that are worth a lot more than $100,000. And if you go get an umbrella policy, they're relatively cheap. You have to have a base level of coverage, but get the umbrella if you have assets. If you can afford it, it's usually a relatively cheap way to increase your coverage, you know, pretty dramatically by $1 million or more. In terms of auto, I mean, auto coverage is where you're most exposed. That's where most injuries come from, is operating your car. Wisconsin used to be 100, 300 for a minimum. 100, when I use the multiple limits, 100 means how much they'll pay for any one person who's injured. 300 is what they'll pay, however many people. If you've got five people injured, the most the company will pay is that second number. We're now at 2550, which is grossly inadequate. I mean, it's mandatory. You're supposed to have it. Still, many people don't. But that's way too little coverage. Again, if you have any assets at all, should have at least 100, 300, and more is better. It doesn't cost a lot to raise that, you know, to go from 2550 to 100, 300. Is not a huge leap, and even to go up to like 250, 500, it's more, but it's not dramatically more. And again, you should look and decide, does it make more sense to go to a higher liability limit or would it be cheaper to just buy an umbrella? They'll require some limit, but if they'll let you buy 100, 300 and do an umbrella, you're probably better off doing that. Finally, and this is one that's just near and dear to my heart, uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage. You're going to have uninsured. It's mandatory. Underinsured, a lot of companies don't write that. They have to offer it, but they don't have to write it. That is critical coverage because that's what takes care of you. If somebody who injures you has insurance, but say they've got $25,000, $50,000 and you have significant injuries, and that's not enough. Underinsured then steps in. They get to subtract whatever you get from the other side, but you want to make sure those limits are significant. There are companies, a couple major companies, that write lower underinsured motorist limits than liability limits. I don't think that should ever be the case. And you should, if that, you should look at your policy. If that is the case, go back to them and say, I want at least as much, you know, underinsured motorist coverage as I have liability coverage. I can't tell you how many claims I've seen in the last 10 years, Larry, where people had lower underinsured limits than their liability limits. So effectively, they're covering other people, you know, for more than they're covering themselves. And the underinsured motorist coverage is so inexpensive, it just makes no sense at all to do that.
Laura in Milwaukee has something that I believe relates kind of to what we've been talking about here. Laura, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I had an accident about 3 years ago where I hit a motorcycle. And it was my fault, although I mean, it's a long story, but anyway, it turned out, according to police and everyone around there, that it was my fault. And it wasn't my car. Now, it belonged to my daughter, and she owns a small business. Now, they're thinking about selling. Is this person that I hit in any way eligible for any kind of funds from my daughter's business? Or if I were to sell my house, would she be eligible for any funds coming from my house?
Okay, those are great questions, Laura. I'm sorry you're dealing with that. It's no fun, but that's why it's so important to have adequate insurance. In your case, first of all, and that's the really important point, when you're operating somebody else's car, their insurance always comes first. So the first thing that happens is they would, if whatever the injuries are, they'd go to that, the insurance company for the car, and they would, you know, if their limits were adequate, that would be it. I mean, they'd pay whatever they needed to pay up to those limits, and if that took care of it, that would take care of it. If it didn't, then your insurance on your car would step in next.
Or a motorcycle. She's got a motorcycle in this case, but it'd be the same?
Well, I think she said she hit a motorcycle.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay.
I might be wrong. I think that's what she said, Larry. So in that case, but if it was a cycle, yeah, it would still be the same thing. It's always the vehicle you're driving is the primary insurance. So if you're operating somebody else's vehicle, their insurance comes first, then yours would step in. So you've got two layers of insurance there. And so that, you know, that hopefully would be helpful. In terms of your daughter's business, we don't have owner's liability in this state. So the owner of a vehicle, unless they've negligently entrusted it to you, you know, if you've had 47 prior accidents and they say, go ahead, take the car, that would be a problem. If you've been, you're at a party and you're drinking heavily and the owner says, go ahead, take the car, that could be a problem for the owner. But just the mere fact that your daughter owns the vehicle does not make her responsible for the injury, and obviously means her business would not be responsible. So that's the answer.
All right, there you go. Does that help, Laura?
It did, but I'm just, what about my house? If I sold my house, I just don't know what's taking so long. It's been 3 years already. Is there statute of limitations?
Yeah, it's a 3-year statute of limitations. You know, insurance companies, frankly, are terrible about keeping their insureds informed of what's going on. They just do an awful job of that. And most companies, I don't tar everybody, but I mean, I've worked with enough of them to know, and I've represented people who are, where the insurer, they are concerned about whether they have enough coverage and they want me to look out for their interests. And companies just aren't very good about it. So, that's something that, you know, I'd go back to the company, first of all, your daughter's insurance company, who's the one who should be handling this, and say, what's going on? Where are we? You know, has this been settled? Is it going to be settled? And if not, I'd talk to your – and I'd also call your own insurance company and say, have you heard anything? Are they talking to you? Where are we? But I'd call the companies and find out exactly what's going on, because I assume if you don't have contact, you can just – if you give them your name and the date, your daughter's name or policy, they can look it up and find out what's going on. But they should be communicating with you. That's – in my mind, really unprofessional not to keep people advised, because of course you worry about those things.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, I mean, would you know, if she, look, if they're, if it got beyond both policies, you know, then could your house be at risk? Or if you sold it, could the proceeds be at risk? They could be. There's a, you know, you get an exemption if you, there are ways to get around that. But, you know, yeah, that could potentially be a problem. But I think you're a long ways from that.
Yeah.
Has anybody sent you what they call them, excess layers, where they write and say you could be exposed to
more
than your
limit? Mike, we got to break in here, Mike. We can pick this up after a quick look at the news. Mike Riley, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking about legal issues on the show today, Larry Mueller here with Michael Riley as my guest, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Great to have him back. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation and arbitration, getting fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence. So, lots of callers online. We, as we broke for the news, we had... Laura on the show from Milwaukee. She was involved in an accident, injured a motorcyclist, and wondered whether or not the victim could take money from the sale of Laura's home. And Mike was in the process of answering that. Mike, sorry for breaking in on you there right at the news break.
No, sorry for being so long-winded. The bottom line is the company, she should talk to both insurance companies, both her own and her daughter's, but the company has an obligation if they believe there's a chance that the case will not be settled or resolved within the coverage, within the limits of their insurance coverage, they have an obligation to send a letter to their insured saying, you know, we've received, you know, that we're concerned that you may not have enough coverage. It's possible. The fact that you get that letter doesn't mean that, in fact, you don't have enough coverage or that it will go over limits. But that's something, if they believe that, if they've received a demand for more than the coverage limits, then they would have an obligation to send that letter. So if she hasn't gotten that, that would be a positive sign, but she should follow up with the companies.
All right. Let's go to Karen in Menasha. Hi, Karen.
Hello there.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
I was involved in an accident where the person that T-boned my vehicle had Allstate for an insurance company, and they used a computer to settle my claim, which was very low. They used pre-existing conditions and et cetera. And they made it very complicated for my attorney to deal with it, consuming the time and paperwork that he had to do for them. I have settled the case, but they had been sued in New York for using the computers to value my worth. Not my worth, but people's worth. Is there anything I can follow up with this to... gain some satisfaction into the settlement and take the burden off the public insurances to have them pay up?
Well, you know, again, that's one where I'd call, you know, a local attorney who does this work and just see if there's anything going on. The answer is probably not. That was likely, you know, a class action that was brought there. Allstate, I mean, every company uses computers. You know, everybody does. And so that's not unique to Allstate. Allstate's been a pain in the neck, but so are most companies. I mean, the reality is companies are far more difficult to deal with than they were 20 years ago. And, of course, computers are, you know, used much more heavily than they were 20 years ago. One of the things that's changed is adjusters, and, in fact, it was an Allstate adjuster who told me that she personally had $50,000 in authority, which meant she could use her judgment to pay up to $50,000. Then, like 5 years ago, they lowered that, or I think 10 years ago, they lowered it to $25,000. 5 years, they lowered it to $5,000. So that's what's happened. They've taken the human element out of it. And instead of having adjusters, you know, the reality is computers you can put in the amount of your medical bills. The amount of your medical bills is a factor. It's not that significant because you can have pretty limited medical bills, for instance, in a wrongful death case where, you know, there's no medical care at all, still a very serious claim. And you can have cases where, you know, the amount of medical care you receive doesn't begin to reflect the severity of the impact of the injury over time. And so that, you know, that's, those are things, I mean, that's why you hire a lawyer. That's what the lawyer has to deal with. You know, and the lawyer, I'm not suggesting it's easy, it's not, but we deal with that every day. That's just part of what we do for our clients. And I doubt you're going to be able to do anything against Allstate for using computers or doing, you know, that's more saying that they've, it's not just the computer, it's just their practice, the way they handle things generally. And a lot of it had to do with basically saying to people, yes, you're in good hands, we'll treat you fairly, when in fact that wasn't the case. But I doubt you can do anything, but that's a good example of why you got to hire the right lawyer. And I'm not critiquing your lawyer. I don't know what he did. He may have done everything that could be done. But you need to be sure you've got a lawyer that's going to fight for you and do everything he can to be sure you're treated fairly.
Thank you very much, Karen, for calling. Rick in Alma Center, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, I'm Mr. Riley. Bike riding in southwestern Wisconsin and was attacked by a big dog and got bit and had to go to the emergency room and got a relatively large bill. The owner of the dog did call after the police report and say they would take care of the part of the bill, but now that the bill is in, they've disappeared. And from looking around, they don't seem to have a lot of assets. Is this worth pursuing as a suit, or is it going to be a lot of work for nothing?
Well, I mean, one, do you know if they have insurance? That they have a home, or what? You know, what's the situation?
No insurance.
No
insurance. Yeah. Well, that, you know, that obviously makes it, you know, much more difficult. The fact is, if they don't have insurance, they probably, I mean, I think it's going to worth going to a lawyer, talking to a lawyer, seeing about sending a demand out. You know, will it produce anything in the end? I can't guarantee you that. But it's also likely that they are not going to try to defend any lawsuit that's brought. And if they don't and they default, you're going to get a judgment, and that judgment's good for 10 to probably 20 years if you know, do the appropriate things. So, you know, it's going to be there. Will it get you something today? And, you know, that it's also going to be, once that judgment's there, that creates real problems for their credit. So, you know, they'll be, you know, and again, if they're, sorry, if they're bums, they're bums. You know, then, yeah, there's probably not much you can do. But, you know, at some point, if they are people who would think about buying a house or even buying a car or buying anything, and their credit rating is important, they're going to find that with that judgment against them, it's going to be darn tough to live in the modern world, because, boy, those things get, you know, it's the days when you could hide from that stuff are long gone. But that's, you know, that's why insurance is so important. If there's not insurance, boy, it makes it a whole lot tougher, you know, to deal with those things, no question about it.
Yeah. Rick, thank you. Gary in Merrill, it's your turn.
Yes, hello. My question involves my grandson. My daughter and my grandson's father, they don't live together. They were never married. My grandson's father's girlfriend brought two pit bulls into the house with my grandson's father, and one of the dogs bit my grandson quite badly. And my question is, can she be sued because her dogs did it, even though she lives with my grandson's father?
Does your grandson live with them?
He goes back and forth. They have joint custody between, yes, he goes back and forth, yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is it what he was living there at the time?
Yes, he was in the house at the time. Yes, for normal back and forth, yes.
I mean, he wasn't just visiting. He was there for the period of time that he spends with them.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the answer is, I mean, she can certainly be sued. You know, she's not immune from suit just because, you know, he lives there. The question would be, will insurance cover it? And insurance policies do often exclude claims by resident relatives for obvious reasons. As, you know, the company doesn't want if somebody in the house does something to injure another resident of the house, they don't want to be responsible for that. I mean, I would certainly, if they do have insurance, I think it'd be worth approaching the insurance company. But, you know, I think that, you know, if in fact he lives there and was living there at the time, it may well be a problem. But, again, it's one of those things that certainly be worth talking to a lawyer specifically about, see what a lawyer tells you. The lawyer would probably want to see the insurance policy and see what the policy says. Again, presuming there's a policy. She's not immune. I mean, she could be sued. But that, again, whether insurance would cover it's another matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sets up its own set of problems within the family. And I don't know, you know, whether what the dynamics are and how big a problem it is. And, you know, that's its own, you know, it's easy to get caught up in just the legalities of this stuff and lose track of the reality. And, you know, that's also a factor, obviously. Is it something where you just don't want to have this kind of dynamic within the family? But that's the answer.
Thank you again for calling, Rick. Gary. Bob in Potosi, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. I was calling, how responsible, at what age does a biological parent, you know, have a real, you know, have biological parent is responsible for personal injuries or property damage caused by his child?
You know, there are rules on that, and I'm sorry, I just haven't had it come up recently. It's 18 is basically it, but usually the biggest one is usually if you sign as a sponsor for a driver's license, then at least up to 18, you generally, I believe it's 18, I'd have to check again, it could be 20, but I believe it is 18, but you remain responsible. Generally speaking, you're not. There is a law that deals with vandalism and some other things by minors, but generally speaking, you're not responsible for just because your kid does something. It doesn't make you responsible. The big concern really is the driver's license, because if you sign as a sponsor, which generally you're going to have to do if your kid wants to drive at 16, that does create an exposure. So you want to make sure you have insurance that's going to take care of that.
All right, Bob, thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Steve in Sullivan next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the show. I got a question on a vehicle damage. About a month ago or so, an EF1 tornado came through the town of Concord, and it broke some trees on my property, and they fell across my truck, and they crushed the truck badly. I don't have comprehensive on that truck because it's an older truck. Is there any option for me to get some compensation from my insurance company?
Probably not. You know, you have to look at what's defined, but that doesn't – I'd look at the policy language, but I don't think that's going to fall within collision coverage. And so that means you'd have to you'd have to get it under comprehensive. And look, a lot of people don't carry comprehensive on older vehicles because it costs a fair amount of money, and it just doesn't really make a lot of sense to do it. You know, it's just the return on investment isn't all that great. And, you know, who expects something like that to happen? I mean, that's just one of those things that, you would never anticipate. But the answer is probably not. I'd look at your policy language just to see if – look at the definition of collision. But collision, this is almost certainly a comprehensive claim, and without that coverage, you probably can't do anything.
Steve, thanks again. Appreciate it. We had a listener email in that they have seen that you can use a whole life insurance policy with a funeral home to guarantee funeral costs in the future. Are there any advantages to this?
You know, I'm so glad that, thank you to the listener, because I know we had that. We've got a lot of topics today, and we didn't quite get to that. I'm real concerned about all these things on TV, which includes reverse mortgages. You know, we'll buy your insurance policy from you. I've seen these same ads about, you know, what I'd look at there is, I mean, what are they going to charge you? What's the return? Can you just go out and buy a term policy for a lot less? Because my guess is you probably can. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, different places you can go online now to look at, you know, compare different term policies. You know, when people are advertising, they're doing it to make money. That's not an evil thing. You know, that's fine. But, you know, you do have to ask with any of these things, you have to ask what's the benefit. There are a lot of ads out there offering to buy your life insurance policy. Well, before you think about that, you know, I talk to the insurance company that issued the policy and say, if I surrender the policy, what will you pay me? Because if somebody's offering to buy it, they obviously think they're going to make a profit. Otherwise, yeah, they wouldn't want to buy it from you. And some of those things are, it just, and again, same thing with reverse mortgages. You know, I know Tom Selleck, you know, I loved him in Magnum P.I. and some of his movies, but, and, you know, I'm not accusing him of anything, but, you know, he's online saying, that's not my first rodeo. Well, okay, but how much do you know about insurance, Tom? You know, I mean, you really need to look carefully at what you're getting into, what it's going to cost you, and what the benefits are. You know, the reverse mortgage, okay, would you be better off just with a regular mortgage, with a loan? And maybe not. Maybe it makes perfect sense for you. But before you do any of those things, look at the alternatives. Make sure you understand, you know, the benefits and the risks. The other one that's been out there for a long time is this stuff where they will advance money. If you're injured, they'll say, okay, you know, if you're injured and you haven't collected yet, then, you know, we'll give you a loan, and then interest rates on those loans are astronomical. If you really have to do that, maybe you have to, but should never be, you know, the first thing that you look at. Lawyers can't advance money. People ask me about that, and lawyers aren't allowed to do that ethically, but that doesn't mean you should run out and get one of those loans unless it's really just, you know, last resort. And again, you know, structured settlements, there were a lot of those out there. We don't do many because they depend on interest rates. That's instead of getting money up front, you get money over a set period of years. There are outfits that say they'll buy those from you. And again, they discount what you're entitled to a lot. So, you know, just look at any of those things really carefully before you jump on board.
Sam in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hello. I am a small business owner, and I have two different businesses, and I was wondering what your thoughts are regarding the business interruption insurance and COVID-19, because so far I know a lot of people have had those struggles, so I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on if that was going to change or if we have any options.
Yeah, I don't know what the companies are doing. I know the argument was that was exempted. I think it was, you know, so often with all these coverages, and who in heaven's name anticipated this? I mean, you know, I mean, other than in our worst nightmares, whoever saw this coming? And, you know, and a few authors, I guess, who've made money on it over the years. But, you know, I think that, you know, as I recall, I believe that the answer has been that most companies at least aren't paying those claims. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, you're eligible for any of the federal programs that, you know, gave some relief, at least to business owners. But I don't know if you're going to see a change. The federal government generally doesn't get involved in insurance. It's usually a state matter. It's regulated by the states. And, you know, the states, frankly, take a pretty laissez-faire attitude. I mean, I don't see many states jumping in and requiring the companies do this, that, or the other than maybe like auto insurance saying you have to issue certain coverages and certain minimum limits. So, you know, I think the first thing I do – the other thing I wanted to talk about, and I'm glad you raised this, is, boy, whatever insurance you're looking at, I talked to more than one agent, and I'd at least talk to an independent agent who may handle multiple companies. Different companies underwrite different things, provide different coverages. There are a lot of similarities, but they're not all identical at all. And so I think it's worth looking around. But companies, and I think understandably in a way, there are things, you know, that they, you know, natural disasters, there are things that they just exclude because obviously if you look at like what's going on in California with some of this stuff, I mean, you'd bankrupt every, and you know, what happened with Ida just now, Gosh, you'd bankrupt half the companies in the country real quickly. So, you know, they do have restrictions. You can look for one that doesn't, but probably not real likely you're going to find one.
Oh, all right. There you go, Sam. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, wow, we've covered a lot here, Mike. And in our last minute and a half, we got anything else that you want to bring up in relation to what we've been discussing?
No, I do think that the one thing I guess I'd say is that everybody, insurance, you know, and lawyers are not any better than anybody else about reading their policy and looking carefully at what they've got. But I would just strongly encourage everyone, take a look at your declarations pages, what they send you that tells you how much coverage you have. Take a careful look at that and ask yourself, you know, is this enough? It really doesn't cost a whole lot to raise your coverage. It doesn't cost a whole lot to get an umbrella policy in most cases. And, again, please look at the underinsured motorist coverage and make sure you have enough. A tragic case recently where wife and husband was killed, wife badly injured on an accident, bizarre, just an accident happened in Kansas, just one of these things out of the blue, horrible thing. And, you know, they had $250 in liability, which certainly wouldn't have been enough. It's never enough for something terrible like that. But would have been what they had was $100 because their agent wrote less underinsured motorist coverage for them and should never have done that, in my view. I don't think that's appropriate at all. But, you know, she wasn't aware. She just assumed that they had the same coverage because that's what people do. Look at your deck page. Make sure you're comfortable. If you have a question, talk to your agent. And you know what? If your agent tells you something about what you got and you have a question, I send them a letter in writing and say, okay, we spoke and here's what you told me. Because I frankly, when I talked to their agent in that case, the agent was in my mind less than very forthcoming about what he had told them. So anyway, those are closing thoughts.
Those are good thoughts to keep in people's heads, Michael. Mike, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope we have a chance to do this again. Appreciate it very much.
It was a delight, Larry, and I hope we can do it in person again one of these days.
Yeah, me too. Thank you, Mike. Michael Riley, our guest, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison, represents a lot of clients in personal injury and insurance coverage issues, and it was great to have him with us today, and we'll get him back. We'll do it again, for sure. Just looking ahead, on the Ideas Network, tomorrow, it's Garden Talk Day. Oh, my gosh, Friday is already coming. And Tova Martin is going to be the guest, and we'll talk with Tova about creating an indoor garden. That's tomorrow, starting at 11 on Garden Talk. In the meantime, there is lots more in store on the Ideas Network right through the afternoon and evening, and I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.